From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Tis the season of the NFL quarterback. Make that quarterbacks, as in an army of them. Ahead on Only a Game, former pro QB Ron Jaworski discusses the NFL's revolving door and the astonishing number of NFL quarterbacks entering and exiting through it. Also, the Oklahoma City Thunder's plan to rumble through L.A. in the spring, and the life of legendary gambler Titanic Thompson. Also, creative auto repair at the 24 Hours of Lemons race.
The car I drive every day is going to be what we scavenge parts off of if this thing breaks. If we launch the engine or something, well, we can replace it, but we're really hoping not to.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Thursday night, Tyler Thigpen started at quarterback for the Miami Dolphins in their game against Chicago. It's only week 11 of a 17-week regular season, but thanks to injuries, poor performances, and a suspension, Thigpen became the 50th quarterback to start an NFL game this year, and that number will climb this weekend. Ron Jaworski was an NFL quarterback for 15 seasons. Today, he's an analyst featured on ESPN's Monday Night Football telecast, and he's also the co-author of The Games That Changed the Game, The Evolution of the NFL in 7 Sundays. Ron Jaworski, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, Bill, great to be with you. And thank goodness I'm not playing right now the way these quarterbacks are going down.
They are indeed. Dallas, Detroit, Oakland, Seattle, Tennessee, and Washington are among the teams that have started at least two quarterbacks. Can you remember a season with more quarterback controversies and injuries at that position?
You know, just off the top of my head, I really can't remember any that jump out. But you know, I can see why. I felt over the last couple of years there has been a dearth of quarterback talent in the National Football League, and it continues to decline. You know, you get guys that were out of football, as a Brian St. Pierre, who will start this weekend for the Carolina Panthers. Last week, he was Mr. Mom. He was at home.
Exactly.
And he gets a chance to start this week. So, you know, you see the quality of play has been deteriorating. I don't think the college ranks are developing young quarterbacks. So consequently, two things happen. Guys get hurt, which is always part of the game, and coaches tend to react quickly when they don't have a quarterback, and very few teams have consistent quarterbacks.
After Donovan McNabb was shipped to Washington, Kevin Cobb started in Philadelphia over Michael Vick. Since then, both men have missed time with injuries, but now Vick is the starter, and his performance Monday night was one of the best of 2010. So can we consider the matter settled in Philadelphia?
Well, I think if Michael Vick continues to play the way he played on Monday night and the way he's played for the most part, it was supposed to be Kevin Cobb to be the Eagles' long-term quarterback, but unfortunately for Kevin, he got injured against the Green Bay Packers in the first half of their opening game. Michael Vick got an opportunity to audition and played very well. But then he got hurt, and Kevin Cobb came back, and actually in the four games that Kevin played, he was the NFC Offensive Player of the Week a couple times. So the Eagles right now, as we're talking about the dearth of talent, it looks like the Eagles have two outstanding quarterbacks on their team, one very young in Kevin Cobb and one really, you know, in the prime of his career in Michael Vick.
Despite the revolving door under center this year, there were 13 300-yard passing games last week. That was an NFL record. Does that sort of statistic have anything to do with the league's new policies regarding helmet-to-helmet hits?
I don't think so. I think it's based on a lot of the rule changes that have happened, the leniency of which defensive backs can play. You know, you can't hit guys after 5 yards. In fact, you can't breathe on them after 5 yards, it seems. So you're getting these clean access routes by wide receivers and attacking safeties and attacking deep, and that's why, you know, you see these chunks of yards in the game. And it's funny, you opened the show talking about my book, and one of the things that I project are these kinds of numbers. You know, Norm Van Brocken's record of 554 yards in one single game, I believe, will be in jeopardy this year, and it might be in jeopardy Monday night when we're out in San San Diego with Phillip Rivers and Kyle Orton slinging it around the field. So it is becoming a passing league. And maybe a statement that Andy Reid made to our production crew for the Eagles game last week. Andy Reid said, every play we run is a red zone play. We want to score on every play.
As you say, quarterbacks have always been an important part of the game of football. They get the ball first and often get a chance to decide what to do with it. But in the past 15 years or so, the position really seems to have taken on even greater significance. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think it takes on more significance because teams are throwing the ball more now. But I got to tell you, I have an office at NFL Films, and I sit there and I look at tape all week, and I also have access to some of the most incredible history of the game. And earlier this week, I was listening to an interview of Vince Lombardi, and he was talking about the quarterback position. You would think it was yesterday, the way he talked about the quarterback position, that of leadership, the hardest worker, the first guy in, the last guy out. And it was just like he was talking about today's quarterback. And this was an interview that NFL Films recorded with Vince Lombardi 53 years ago. So I don't think the position has changed at all.
Of course, the quarterback is also the guy most likely to be featured in People magazine in a given week. And that has some importance to the NFL, of course, the way it's marketed.
Like I said, the quarterback is normally the face of a football team, and he is the guy that touches the ball on every single play. And if he's not a guy that's not at the top of his game, the likelihood your team will lose is good.
We've talked about controversies. We've talked about injuries and quarterbacks coming and going. Tell us about some of the signal callers who have most impressed you this season.
Yeah, one guy that's really impressed me this year, and his team's not playing that great football right now, but it's been Kyle Orton. It's a Denver team that's not running the football very well, yet Kyle Orton's passing statistics and play action have been through the roof. And then I also get a guy that's kind of quietly doing his job, and that's David Garrard down in Jacksonville. He's not one of those flashy kind of guys, but if you look at him from a statistical profile and keeping his team in ball games, and now the Jacksonville Jaguars have a winning record, it certainly is David Garrard. But a guy that's also playing at a very high level is Phillip Rivers out in San Diego. He's on track to throw for over 5,000 yards and break Dan Marino's yardage record. And despite all the injuries that the San Diego Chargers have had, to their wide receiving core and their tight end Antonio Gates didn't play last week, Phillip Rivers is lighting it up and basically put the San Diego Chargers on his shoulder and carried the football team.
All right, Ron, before I let you go, we talked about Brian St. Pierre, who will be trying to make the transition from stay-at-home dad to starting quarterback. And I have to ask, it's only been a couple of decades since you retired. Are you expecting a call before the year's out?
If the Arena Football League called, I might be able to play, because I can still throw it about 40 or 50 yards.
Former NFL quarterback Ron Jaworski is a football analyst for ESPN. He's also the co-author of The Games That Changed the Game, The Evolution of the NFL in 7 Sundays. Ron, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, it was my pleasure and a blast. Thank you.
The Los Angeles Lakers' annual run to the NBA Finals has been almost as routine as cosmetic surgery in Hollywood. But the Oklahoma City Thunder may be developing into serious Western Conference challengers. The Thunder, anchored by the NBA's defending scoring champion and a group of young, promising players, is giving OKC fans something to cheer about, as Only a Game's Greg Eklund reports.
Oklahoma City has had to pull itself together many times over the years. From the Murrah Building bombing to devastating tornadoes and a crippling economy, the city has met many challenges. The Oklahoma City Thunder, including its 33-year-old general manager, Sam Presti, preaches the mantra, rise together.
The way we want to build our organization and the values that we share as a business and a team run parallel with those of the city. And, when we first arrived here, that was one of the first things that dawned on us.
Presti patterns an unselfish team with the work ethic like the Thunder's fans in Oklahoma City.
I think there's great fiber in Oklahoma City. The resiliency of the people here, the selflessness of the community, and the willingness to continue to help each other and pick each other up, the optimism of the city, the continued growth and the rise that the city is experiencing, and just a genuine work ethic that is found within the people that live here.
At the end of last season, The Thunder were the youngest team in the NBA at an average of 25 years and 42 days, yet the team improved to 50 and 32 after a terrible 23 and 59 season, good for the eighth biggest turnaround in NBA history. They stubbornly gave the Los Angeles Lakers problems in the opening round of the playoffs with the best-of-seven series tied 2-2 before the Lakers clinched it in six games. For a team with higher expectations this year, the Thunder are off to a shaky start, but Coach Scott Brooks has a different sense about this year's team.
Well, a year ago I knew that we had to keep getting better. I didn't know if we were going to end up being a good team. I just know that the guys were working hard and improving every day during the summer and in training camp. This year I know we have a good team.
The Thunder are led by Kevin Durant, who at 21 became the youngest player in NBA history to win a scoring title. While the league was abuzz last summer about LeBron James choosing to leave Cleveland for the money in Miami, Durant quietly signed a five-year extension with the Thunder. Darnell Mayberry, the Thunder beat writer for the Daily Oklahoman, says the decision fits his profile.
That's the thing. He said he wants to be here in Oklahoma City, and he proved it by signing a five-year deal, the maximum amount of years that he could sign for, and he's committed to this community.
Last summer, Durant and Thunder teammate Russell Westbrook led the U.S. team to its first world championship in 16 years. But after the championships, Durant hardly took any time off to rest. So it has Brooks thinking about his minutes played this season.
You know, I think about that, you know, throughout the game, but I don't let that as the sole factor on how I coach Kevin or the other guys. The game dictates the minutes.
Because of early season injuries, Durant has spent more time on the floor than what Brooks prefers. And with opponents paying more attention to Durant, he's been forced to work harder for his points. He's averaging almost 30 points per game, but his turnovers are up. Before a recent home game at the downtown Ford Center, Durant said all the fuss about his minutes is overblown.
Yeah, it is. You know, I'm just playing the game. I like to play as much as I can and help this team win. You know, I'm just trying to get better, man. That's all I'm trying to do.
Outside the Ford Center, a full window sign is visible that says Oklahoma City is a brotherhood. That's how the Thunder team sees itself. And Philadelphia 76ers coach Doug Collins says the word has circulated around the league.
My son was one of the assistant coaches on that team, and he spent it with him this summer. Those three players had. They would get up in the morning, they would have breakfast, they would practice, they would go back to the hotel, they would work out, they would lift weights, they would have lunch, they would go back to the gym that night. And so they've developed incredible chemistry.
The Thunder played to almost 99% capacity crowds at the Ford Center last season and have started strong at the gate again. But the home crowd has already witnessed early season losses to Utah, Boston, and San Antonio. What they'd really like is another crack at the Lakers in the playoffs, and Brooks says they might get it.
Lakers, you know, they're defending champs. They've been to the finals, you know, 3 years in a row. They have as much talent as any team in basketball. We have to continue, the league will continue to find ways to beat them, and right now, they're winning.
For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in Oklahoma City.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Mary Jane Murphy, a.k.a. Tiger, was honored at the Oaklawn Park District in Illinois this week for her exceptional tennis career. She's played doubles twice a week for the past 30 years at the Oaklawn Racquet Club outside Chicago, where she is a charter member. Tiger Murphy has taught fellow members foolish enough to take her on to respect her overhead smash and the variety of spins she puts on the ball. When the mother of 10 and grandmother of 30 was recently accused of being unnecessarily aggressive, Tiger Murphy, who is 90 years old, acknowledged that she likes to win. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, the great big cons of Titanic Thompson. But first, before the current women's college basketball season began, Connecticut head coach Gino Auriemma announced that his team's winning streak, which began 2 years ago and has now reached 80 games, would be broken this season. Joining me now to evaluate that proposition and discuss various other matters pertaining to women's hoops is Michelle Smith of AOL Fan House. Michelle, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Bill.
The Connecticut streak almost did come to an end when the Huskies played Baylor, led by Brittany Griner, on Tuesday night, but UConn prevailed 65-64. Baylor is number two in the country. Which team, if any, validates Coach Auriemma's preseason prediction?
Well, I will say this. I think he's right. I think, you know, Baylor could have done it. That game was an interesting game of swings. I think at one point Connecticut was up by 15, and then they were down by 8 and ended up pulling it out. They are going to play Ohio State at Madison Square Garden in December. I think that's a possibility. I don't know if it's a likelihood, but I think it could happen there. I think it could happen at Stanford on December the 30th. I think it could well happen there. And it could happen in the Big East. But I think Gino's right. I think the air of invincibility about that team with Tina Charles and Kalena Green and some of the other players they had is gone. They're playing a lot of young players around Maya Moore. And I think that streak comes to an end this year.
That Baylor played UConn as tough as they did may have surprised some observers. Kelly Griffin, who figured to be Baylor's starting point guard, left the team just before the season began. She had started 50 consecutive games before that. How many teams could survive that sort of loss?
Now, that was a big loss and kind of a shock. But, you know, on the other hand, Baylor's team really isn't about what's going on at point guard. So if you can get somebody to get the ball to Brittany Griner, then you're okay. You know, Baylor's a really good team, and there's a lot. Melissa Jones there, they've got experienced players. They're not necessarily, you know, seniors and older players, but they've got a lot of players who played a lot last season and a lot of experience, and I think that helped them absorb Griffin's last-minute departure.
Unlike UConn, the fourth-ranked University of Tennessee team has not played great opponents early. Pat Summitt's women won their first few games by scores like 110-60, 86-53, and this beauty, 103-43. What exactly?
They're just getting warmed up. Pat always schedules tough, and I think maybe she's pulled the throttle back a little on her program because they've struggled so much the last two or three years. But they've got plenty of tough teams on their schedule, and they'll have some interesting games coming up.
All of the Pac-10 coaches picked Stanford, ranked third in the country, to win that conference again this season. This perhaps didn't surprise you.
No. Stanford's won 11 straight titles. I mean, they still pretty much own the Pac-10. And the question isn't whether Stanford wins the Pac-10. It's whether Stanford comes all the way back to the Final Four for the fourth consecutive year and can actually win the championship, because they've been now 3 years in a row. They've played in the championship game twice. And they haven't won. And, you know, I think that's starting to stick in their craw. I think they thought that game against Connecticut last year, as ugly as it was and not appealing as it was a winnable game for them, and that they let that slip away.
Michelle, in the spring, the Pac-10 is going to combine the women's and men's tournaments. Do you like this idea, and do you see it spreading to other conferences?
I like the idea for the Pac-10. The women's tournament has not done incredibly well in the Pac-10 in terms of attendance and interest, and it's something to try. I'm not sure it's the answer, but I think at this point you've got to give it a go and see if you can get more fans in the building and maybe more crossover fans. I'm not sure it needs to work for other conferences. I think the Big 12 conference does just fine with separating its two conferences. I think the Big East tournament does fine, but some of these postseason conference tournaments, the women don't draw very well, and the Pac-10 has been one of those.
Duke has the number 6-ranked women's team, which might be a bigger deal if Duke didn't have the number 1-ranked men's team. Do the women draw as many Cameron crazies to their building as the men do?
They do really well. I mean, these have been two good programs for a long time, and Duke's a basketball school, certainly, and they do really well. They're not paling by comparison.
While we're on the subject of Duke, we should acknowledge that Coach Joanne McCalley got her 400th victory when Duke overwhelmed Southern California 75-50 on Monday evening. Coach McCalley said, and I'm quoting now, "I don't know if that's good or bad or what it is, but it's good, right?"
Yeah. Now, Joanne's a young coach, you know, in relative terms, and she's had a really nice career at Michigan State and at Maine, and then now certainly at Duke, and, you know, she's got a good team, and she's got great recruiting class that she brought in there this year. So there's good things in the future, in the immediate future for Duke, definitely.
Ohio State, ranked 7th nationally and winners of 31 games last season, has returned all 5 starters. It's never a bad thing to be able to do that, right?
No, it's not. The hang-up on Ohio State is not what happens during the regular season, where they win Big Ten titles and Jantel Lavender is the 3-time conference player of the year. It's what happens when they get to the NCAA tournament, where I think 5 out of the last 6 years they've lost to a lower-seeded team. They keep getting upset. They keep getting knocked out before they want to get knocked out, before people think they should get knocked out. And that's kind of the anvil that hangs around that program.
Hmm. All right, Michelle, we have talked pretty much exclusively about very good teams. Have you got any sleepers for us, teams that are either ranked below the top 10 or maybe not ranked at all, but they might knock off a Stanford or a Tennessee or even a UConn?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, you know, we've had conversations about this whole idea of mid-majors and, you know, these programs that certainly play well enough. I mean, last year, you know, there were programs like San Diego State in the Sweet 16, Gonzaga got in the Sweet 16. You know, Xavier is a highly, highly ranked program with some very good players not playing in a major conference. And, you know, I think that there are more of those schools that can find themselves in the rankings, more of those schools that are going to find themselves in that Sweet 16 at some point Elite Eight level. It's whether or not they make the push to that next step and you see it a mid-major and a Final Four. It's been a long time.
Michelle Smith writes about women's basketball and various other things for AOL Fan House. Michelle, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks, Bill.
Titanic Thompson was tall and thin rather than Titanic. He was also born Thomas rather than Thompson. But a lot of the legend that grew up around one of the world's most creative and successful hustlers was verifiable, at least according to his victims. In Titanic Thompson, the man who bet on everything, Kevin Cook tells the story of this fellow who found an angle in every proposition. Kevin Cook joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Glad to be here.
Alvin Thomas, the boy who would become Titanic Thompson, was born in 1892. How old was he when he began beating family members out of their pennies at poker?
Well, he wasn't 10 yet. He was just about to become an elementary school dropout at the age of 5 or 6, began taking his uncle's money in penny ante games, and that didn't make him very popular with his aunts.
As far as you could determine, did he cheat right from the start?
Titanic's philosophy from the very beginning was, if you can't beat him, cheat him. But he would rather beat you straight up, which he could do. A remarkable athlete, nobody was more dedicated to practice than he was, and he really never made a bet that he wasn't quite confident he was going to win.
Thomas became Thompson when a newspaper man made a mistake and the subject of the story didn't bother to correct it. But when did people start calling Alvin Thomas, a.k.a. Thompson, Titanic?
Well, he became Titanic in 1912. It was months after the Titanic sank. And Alvin Thomas was a young fellow moseying into a pool hall in Joplin, Missouri. After he had cleaned out everyone in the place, he asked for the proprietor, that was Snow Clark, and saw that there was a sign in the window that said, "Anyone who can leap over my brand new pool table gets $200. Well, young Alvin comes back with a mattress he bought at a hotel down the way, takes an Olympic-caliber jump over the top, lands on the mattress, collects his $200, at which point somebody says to Snow Clark, "What's the name of that young fellow?" And he says, "I don't rightly know, but it ought to be Titanic because he sinks everybody." Now, Alvin liked the sound of that a lot better than the sound of Alvin and became Titanic thereafter.
One of the more creative cons Titanic Thompson worked when he was still a child, about 10 years old, involved his dog as an accomplice. Would you explain how that one worked?
Well, his dog Carlo was a great fetching dog, as he said. What he did was bet a dapper gentleman with a brand new rod and reel that Titanic really coveted. He bet him, you know, my dog is such a great fetching dog, I can throw a rock in this fishing hole, and he'll dive down to the bottom and get that same rock, bring it back. I'll bet my 22 rifle against your nice rod and reel. And the fisherman says, hold on a second. How am I going to know that that's the rock that you threw? If he comes up with the wrong rock, I'm not going to pay off. Titanic said, here, I'll show you what. He marks an X on that rock. Alvin spends the rest of that summer fishing trout with the fabulous rod and reel, and the man never found out that Alvin had spent the entire night before sitting by that fishing hole, picking up rocks and marking them with X's. The bottom of the fishing hole was really littered with those rocks. And Titanic would do variations on something that worked throughout the rest of his career.
You write that what drove Thompson was, quote, his compulsion to prove that he could beat any man at anything. At what point did anything come to include golf?
He was in his 30s already before he ever hit a golf ball. He happened to go past a driving range in the middle of nowhere and larruped a ball practically 300 yards with his first swing. He then wound up playing both left-handed and right-handed. The man was really a remarkable athlete whom Ben Hogan would later call the best shot maker I ever saw, a man who would probably have made millions as a professional golfer had he been born a generation later.
Thompson beat Ben Hogan, and he beat the rest of the golfers of his day, but he said that he'd never play on the pro golf tour because he didn't want to take a pay cut. Still, weren't the guys on the pro golf tour at that time, Sam Snead and the rest of those guys, constantly hustling each other? I'd have thought Thompson would have felt right at home there.
They were. He was a generation older than those fellows. One thing that Byron Nelson said was, you know, we were betting $100. He never needed to play with us because when we were hustling $100, he was playing for
$25,000. You suggest that a lot of what Titanic Thompson accomplished as a hustler resulted from his enormous capacity for practice. Give us an example how, for him, practice made not necessarily perfect, but certainly rich.
Certainly, yes, and near perfect. He was, for instance, fabulous at flipping playing cards. One thing Titanic would mention, for instance, to offer a seemingly impossible bet, was I will clip off the flower across the room by the stem with a playing card. Now, a playing card isn't really heavy enough to do that, so he would strike that stem, then he would throw another playing card and throw another playing card, each one hitting the stem at the same spot until finally it tumbled like a tree in the forest. And all you could hear is the applause from the other fellows. But if they're sporting at all, they laugh and pay up. If they didn't initially want to pay up, then they're going to be looking down the barrel of a gun, and they are going to pay up one way or the other.
Well, as you mentioned, looking down the barrel of a gun, Thompson allegedly killed five guys.
Well, in those days, you know, you can't go to the police and say, a heister just burst through the door and stole the piles of thousands of dollars that we were playing poker with. So you have to defend yourself. He was very good at doing that. He was always armed with his Colt 45, a fabulous shot. And he always figured that if the victims, those five men that he killed, if they were still around to talk to us, they would say they all deserved it.
According to your research, Titanic Thompson cheated Al Capone out of $500. He also hustled Arnold Rothstein, the legendary gambler and gangster who fixed the 1919 World Series. How did Thompson live to be 82 years old?
Well, he was smart enough to let Capone go with just that one little burn that he put on him. So he got out of town, got out of Chicago, went on to New York in a remarkable time during Prohibition in the late 20s, and actually hustled Rothstein, and it became part of the crime of the century, which was the death of Rothstein in a card game after Titanic double-crossed him.
I'm speaking with Kevin Cook, the author of Titanic Thompson, The Man Who Bet on Everything, and you're listening to Only a Game. At one point in his hustling life, Titanic Thompson is alleged to have said, I famoused myself out of a good situation. What occasioned that comment, and what did he mean by it?
Well, it was a good point for him to understand. In his day, you could often go into a small town or even a mid-sized town, you clean every pocket, and you're out of there before word gets around. The police aren't in contact with each other from one city to another. By the time you get to the next town, you're as unknown as you were motor into the first. But after the Rothstein case, suddenly Titanic is testifying in open court in New York City in the case of the year. His picture is in all the newspapers. This was after Damon Runyon wanted to write Titanic's life story, and Titanic said, well, mine ain't the kind of business that publicity helps. So he turned Runyon down. Runyon was forced to fictionalize him into Skye Masterson, the character that Marlon Brando plays in Guys and Dolls. But what Titanic realized after his picture is in all the newspapers with the headline Unbeatable Gambler, that doesn't help you much when you get to Kansas City and the people at the local country club are saying, oh, here's the guy nobody could possibly beat. He famoused himself out of town after town, and there were fewer. Now suddenly the FBI is knocking on his door. Things became more difficult for him.
Very late in the book, Thompson appears at the World Series of Poker in 1969. He was 78 years old. Everybody made a big fuss over him, but you end one paragraph with this sentence: he left broke and nobody said goodbye. I wonder if that might have made a good epitaph for the guy.
Oh, it could be. There are so many good epitaphs in the world that he moved in. There was when Minnesota Fats died, they buried him under a stone that said, St. Peter, rack him up. and when the great Nick Dandelos, Nick the Greek, died penniless, as so many gamblers do in Los Angeles, the high rollers back in Vegas sent a hearse for him to drive Dandelos' coffin back to Vegas, where it's buried in Las Vegas under a picture of a couple of dice, which is their pun on his destination, a pair of dice. Titanic, it's true that when he went out, nobody was around to say goodbye. I think he felt he had his heyday, and he did make a few more human connections later in life, particularly with his family.
Kevin Cook is the author of Titanic Thompson, The Man Who Bet on Everything, published by Norton. He joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Kevin, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, you know I once was a gambler. Boy, but I lost my money wrong.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking at Nuance.com. This is NPR.
11-year-old Brandon Hale of Marysville, Washington, was tossing his boomerang last June when it veered out over the Skagit River, plunged into the water, and floated away. So much for that, Brendan thought, until a recent duck hunting trip with his grandfather brought them to Skagit Bay, where Brandon found his boomerang on the beach. It had floated 10 miles down the river and ended up on property owned by Brendan's family. When he got home that evening, Brendan rushed up to his mom and said, "Mom, boomerangs really do come back." Brendan, she replied, "You're an idiot." No, she didn't really say that. She probably gave the kid a hug. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, where old cars go to race and perhaps to get transplants. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our conversation about the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill. Wait a minute now. You and Ron Jaworski? That is a collision. That is a quasar of football knowledge unseen on National Public Radio ever.
I'm sure you're right about that. Mississippi State booster Bill Bell has said that he received a text from a shadowy agent type named Kenny Rogers. Thank you for the sound effects. And the text contained an alleged payment plan for the services of Auburn quarterback and Heisman favorite Cam Newton. This prompted Rogers' attorney to call his client's decision, quote, stupid. It's never good when your attorney calls you stupid,
well,
is it?
Well, that's because your attorney is going to argue stupid and not criminal at some future legal proceeding, since the FBI is mucking around in this case now. You have to admire the organization when you come right down to it. Very few people structure a payment plan prior to stomping all over NCAA rules.
It is NASCAR's ultimate weekend, Mr. NASCAR. Do you foresee Denny Hamlin getting knocked off the top of the pile?
No, it's hard to imagine unless he gets in his car and runs over a member of the France family or something in pit road before the race. No, I suspect he will hang on. I think the Kevin Harvick-Jimmy Johnson fight for second place is interesting.
This week, President Obama named 15 people who will receive the 2010 Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor, and Bill Russell was among them. Good choice, huh?
Oh, absolutely. He and Stan Musial, by the way. You talk about guys from our childhood. Yeah, I mean, Russell's going to certainly liven up the ceremony.
Of Miami Heat head coach Eric Spoelstra, Heat forward Chris Bosh said this week, quote, "He wants to work, we want to chill." What could possibly go wrong in South Beach?
Well, first of all, Eric Spoelstra is about 11 years old. Number two, Pat Riley is sitting there in what everybody except him apparently perceives to be the wings. And he's got this magnificent three-man rotation that has been brought in specifically to win a championship, and they're floundering a little bit. And now Chris Bosh, who's been the least of the three in terms of his on-court performance, has decided he's going to explain to the coach when it's time to work and when it's time to chill. There's not much possibly can go wrong there.
In Chris Bosh's defense, I should mention that he didn't make this comment until after the game in which he'd scored 35 points. He did finally have a great game.
Yeah, I saw that, although the people in Miami point out that they've already had a lot of off days, more off days than they've had in a long time.
The big news in women's college basketball is that UConn, now riding an 80-game winning streak, almost lost to Baylor on Tuesday. Various UConn veterans watching the game were tweeting to one another throughout. Have you a favorite message among those tweets?
I think Tina Charles was less than impressed by Kim Mulkey's gold blazer or whatever it was she was wearing, and she said, "And the what not to wear outfit goes to," she typed, I think it's about 15 O's here, and then paren drum roll, Kim Mulkey. Which is pretty cool, actually.
Concern for player safety in the National Football League has led to suggestions regarding new rules, new helmets that offer more protection, and so on. Some have now said that a wider field would make the game less dangerous. What do you think?
Well, I just think it gives, and I think Troy Polamalu has a point here. I think that it gives defensive backs more time to line somebody up and more time for the distance to run. I admire the NFL's attempt to do something about the safety of its game, but sooner or later people have to realize you can't play this game safely. This game is not designed to take care of the human body.
NHL chief disciplinarian Colin Campbell has come under intense criticism after it was learned he characterized Bruins center Mark Savard as, quote, a faker in emails 3 years ago. Campbell failed to suspend Pittsburgh's Matt Cook for a vicious elbow to Savard's head this spring. Do you think NHL players deserve better than Colin Campbell?
Oh, there's no question now. I mean, he's got too many conflicts of interest at this point. He's complaining about referees calling penalties on his son, who plays in the league now. I mean, he can't do anything as regards Mark Savard or probably the Bruins with any credibility left at all. It's time for him to go.
Golfers have often come up with creative excuses for poor play, Charlie. I know I used to when I played golf. How'd you like John Daly's explanation this week for his putting woes?
Yeah, he's apparently lost too much weight.
Yeah.
Can't figure out. He's off balance or something. I think balance has been a problem for John Daly in many areas, so I'm inclined to take him seriously.
Well, he says he used to rest his elbows on his love
on
handles
the flab,
when
yeah.
he was putting, and he doesn't have that anymore. I love it.
Can't he get like a fat suit like they wear in the movies, or a tire he can put around his waist when he putts?
Well, as soon as we're finished, you email him.
There we go.
You'll probably get a cut of everything he wins from here on out. Until fairly recently, it looked as if Major League Soccer's championship game would include either David Beckham or Thierry Henry, if not both of them. Instead, Beckham of Los Angeles and Henry of New York will watch as FC Dallas and the Colorado Rapids play tomorrow for the title. Two accomplished teams, but bad luck for the league, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, pretty much, although I'm sure Thierry Henry will be around to give the winner a hand. I'm not over it yet, by the way, Bill. But this will be the third consecutive year in which the MLS crowns a new champion,
exactly.
A first-time champion. So people who are looking for parity, all the baseball people who are worried about the same teams making the playoffs, look to the MLS for how to do it.
Meanwhile, worse luck for FC Gold Pride, winners of the
Beyond their name?
Yeah, that has some problems too, but they won the Women's Pro Soccer Championship this year. They're out of business.
Yeah.
Same thing happened last year to the LA Soul, the team with the best regular season in 2009. I'm wondering if the message in the WPS is, don't be too good.
Heck no, don't win. You'll go out of business. But I also think the biggest problem is they have teams named after what seems to be an infomercial television scam that runs at 4 o'clock in the morning. FC Gold Pride, call now. Operators are standing by.
Your gold, we buy.
Exactly.
Exactly. U.S. anti-doping agency officials recently met with French authorities and members of Interpol as part of an investigation of American cyclist Lance Armstrong. Interpol, shouldn't they have brought in the Navy SEALs, Delta Force, and the DC Comics Justice League?
Well, I think Uncle, too. I think Napoleon Solo and Ilya Kuryakin on the case.
Exactly.
Yes, of course, the drug warriors are now making this into an international crime certificate, you know, that's costing them 1 billion pieces of credibility. I wish this whole thing would go away.
And finally, Charlie, it's tough work being Bucky Badger, the mascot of the University of Wisconsin football team, on any game day. But boy, I guess it was especially hard last Saturday. Would you care to explain why?
Yeah, they have to do push-ups for the points that the Badgers score, and the Badgers, of course, managed to struggle through to 83 against Indiana. And apparently, at one point, late in the game, a safety intercepted a pass returner for a 37-yard touchdown. One of the Badgers in question said, "How the hell am I going to do this with a 35-pound head on?" Now, I've been to a lot of football games at the University of Wisconsin, Bill. Usually the people get the 35-pound head on the day after the game.
And they aren't wearing funny suits. Charlie Fierce is the author of Idiot America, among other books. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
This Sunday in Homestead, Florida, NASCAR will crown its 2010 Sprint Cup Series champion. Denny Hamlin owns an exceedingly thin 15-point lead on Jimmy Johnson, while third-place driver Kevin Harvick is just 46 points behind. Last month, Only a Game's Ron Schachter visited Illinois to witness a racing series that's a world apart from the glitter and horsepower of NASCAR, and where the command, "Gentlemen, start your engines," can be a tall order.
Digger up about $2,000.
Brake lights are good.
Kill switch works.
Outside of a garage 2 hours before race time, two inspectors consult a checklist as they scrutinize the 1992 Ford Escort drooping in front of them. The insides of the vehicle have been ripped out except for a driver's seat, shoulder harness, and a silvery new set of roll bars built into its tottering frame. The outside is battered, its dented sides covered in tacky wood grain contact paper.
It was the side ones here.
Okay.
We had them mounted here.
Gotcha.
On the roll cage, and they made us put them on the floor.
Okay, let me take a peek at that then.
Welcome to the Rod Blagojevich Never Say Die 500, one of the 22 weekend installments of the endurance race known as the 24 Hours of Le Mans. It's named for its more famous counterpart in Le Mans, France. But this five-year-old racing series with a sense of humor requires that competitors spend no more than $500 and an unlimited amount of elbow grease on their cars, and then race them as hard and long as they can for the better part of 2 days. Le Mans was the brainchild of racing journalist Jay Lamb, who believed that substandard cars deserved their day on the track and posed an interesting challenge to those driving them.
Most racing now is money-driven, it's checkbook-driven, and what you do if you have a problem is you tend to spend your way out of it. And what we're trying to do here is present an alternative set of solutions where you don't have the option of using the checkbook wrench to solve your problem. You actually have to use your brain and your creativity and figure out your own way with your own hands how to get the car to work again and how to make it faster.
The strict $500 limit doesn't apply to safety equipment. Racers are allowed to spend as much as they need for roll bars, brakes, fire-resistant driver suits, and state-of-the-art helmets. So far, Lamb adds, there haven't been any serious injuries during Le Mans races.
No, we don't want any leaks.
All right, need a small hose, I need a bolt and 2 clamps.
On this October Saturday morning, 87 vehicles past their prime have arrived at Joliet's Autobahn racetrack. They range in age from a 1971 Porsche to a woebegone 2002 Chevy Cavalier. Their owners have paid a $500 entry fee plus an additional $150 each for the 4 or 5 drivers who will take turns behind the wheel. Alan Caesar, the 20-something owner of the ancient Ford Escort, came here from Woodstock, Illinois, about 75 miles away. He's never raced before and is hoping that 1992 was a very good Ford vintage. But just in case, Caesar is ready for car trouble and notes that the 1998 Ford Escort he's driven here may end up serving as more than his regular ride.
The car I drive every day is going to be what we scavenge parts off of if this thing breaks. We bought some expensive racing pads, but they might not last the weekend. Yeah, apparently this kind of racing is real hard on brake pads. If we launch the engine or something, well, we can replace it, but we're really hoping not to.
In honor of the disgraced Illinois governor and namesake of this event, Caesar dubbed his fledgling racing outfit Team Resignation and planted a life-size effigy of Richard Nixon in what used to be the trunk of his racing car.
All right, we got the rear yet?
A 100 feet away on a prime patch of pit row, in front of a racing trailer, Team Police Brutality puts the finishing touches on a creation that gives new meaning to hybrid vehicle, as team member Ron Vickers explains.
We like to bring out unique cars. Everything inside the frame rails is a 1993 Toyota MR2 that was smashed in the front. The body is a 77 Lancia. It's like a $200 Craigslist car. So we cut floor pan completely out of the Lancia, cut the body completely off of the Toyota, and, you know, with a couple of zip ties and some duct tape and some Bondo, there you have it.
Like most Lemons races, this one takes Saturday night off and actually runs for a total of almost 15 daytime hours on Saturday and Sunday. And like its famous French cousin, the race goes on even in the rain. An added challenge for those drivers with broken wipers or without windshields at all. Within the first 15 minutes, a half dozen vehicles have pulled off or been towed off the track, sending their team scurrying for solutions to mechanical problems.
Where is it? It's got to be fuel.
Cars also begin arriving at the garage where they were first inspected, now renamed the penalty box. They've been black flagged for infractions ranging from bumping other cars on the track to going too fast on pit row.
How's it going?
Good.
You know why you're here?
Did I pass someone on yellow?
You did pass someone on yellow. Hey, why'd you do it?
I think I wasn't paying attention on the street.
That's exactly what you were doing. You weren't paying attention.
Before the offenders return to the road, they may have to paint their faces white and mime their infractions. Or the entire team may have to assemble a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle on the hood of their car. And then there's the tribute to no-nonsense Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio, famous for humiliating male inmates by having them wear pink all the way down to their underwear. In the Lemons version, penalized team members linked to each other by a plastic chain don pink T-shirts and bloomers and parade down pit row, proclaiming their transgression over a bullhorn to the tune of I Fought the Law.
I'm sorry I hit your car. I'm sorry I hit your car.
By 2 in the afternoon, the rain has stopped, but so has the chronically overheated engine in Team Resignation's Ford Escort. Alan Caesar proves prophetic and prepared as his team hoists the engine out of his everyday car for an automotive transplant.
All right,
okay.
Good?
Out.
Oh, all right.
Yay!
Yes. All right, we're halfway there.
They'll work into the night, and at 9 a.m. on Sunday morning, 72 of the original 87 teams, Team Resignation included, are back on the track. The numbers fall to 45 near day's end. Still, most of the battered competitors, keeping to the never-say-die theme, managed to return for the final laps and exit to the applause of pit row. There's no hung jury in this trial, as the Skidmarks racing team steers a diminutive 1995 Dodge Neon 505 laps to the traditional Lemons first prize, $1,500 in nickels. Alan Caesar is just happy to finish the race, logging 263 laps for 66th place. The post-mortem he offers is for the Ford Escort that made the supreme sacrifice.
once we finally decided to tear into my car, I kind of had a few minutes where I just had to, like, emotionally detach myself from this car because I've owned it for, like, 7 years. Yeah, it's treated me well, and now the engine kind of lives on in this entirely new enterprise. I'm really glad that car gets to live on in this thing.
The 24 Hours of Lemons tour, meanwhile, lives on this weekend at Laissez Les Crap Heaps Roulet, just outside of New Orleans. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
Your car broke down.
Yeah.
Your car broke down. Look at them rims.
No.
Look at that speaker.
Right.
Your car piece of junk.
Your car is a piece of junk. Your car is a piece of junk. Your car is a piece of junk. Your car is a piece of junk. Your car is a piece of junk. Your car is a piece of junk. Your car is a piece of junk.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Jack Flagler is our intern, and we had help this week from John Hawken at KCUR in Kansas City. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Ron Jaworski, who offers this assessment.
You're awesome, man. Thank you.
You know, not since I spoke with Katarina Witt have I felt so happy with a guest's assessment of my work.
Little Field, that's such a cute name. Little Field. I'm sorry.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Overheats every 2 minutes and it goes so slow, won't do the speed limit. Now, six people in the car getting down. I turn left, I'm off the drag's ground. Like, that was the sound. And everybody on the street turns around and says,
your car is a piece of junk. Your car is a piece of junk. Ooh, your car is a piece of junk. Your car is a piece of junk.
Support comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at GatesFoundation.org. The Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections and celebrating National Adoption Month at AECF.org. And the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at Edutopia.org. This is NPR.